is waiting outside my window. Bella ciao, Bella ciao, Bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Drag my friends out into the sunlight. Well, there are things that I must do. Wish me luck now, I have to leave you. Hello and welcome to the show. You're listening to Indie Media Radio London on Resonance FM 104.4. Yay! And it's over. The European Social Forum, that is, or as one eager delegate called it, the European Socialist Forum. Well, last week and over the weekend, there were hundreds of meetings, discussions, big-name speakers, parties, and out-on-the-streets actions and demonstrations. A fantastic range of events were held, with many concentrated up at Alexandra Palace. Around 20,000 people attended the main event, with around 5,000 staying in the emergency cheap accommodation at the Millennium Dome. Now, the autonomous spaces and initiatives which had organised outside the official ESF process also accommodated up towards 1,000 people in various squats and social centres around London. Indeed, on the last night, Sunday, after the Dome had closed, they accommodated many of the official ESF visitors who'd become refugees after the official accommodation had closed. On Sunday, there was a large demonstration in central London. Views about the numbers differ wildly, with the police saying around 20,000 and the organisers claiming up to 100,000. Now, the police tended to, we think, just estimate the numbers of people who arrived in Trafalgar Square. But as the march itself was held up at many different places along the route, people arrived in blocks of 5,000 to 10,000, so it is quite possible that the numbers were up to 100,000, although many commentators said it was between 50,000 and 70,000. Either way, it was a big demo. The main theme of the demonstration was Bush out, troops out. Yeah. However, it was supposed to be a multi-issue protest, and many Europeans from the European Social Forum process were angry that the official closing ESF demonstration had been claimed by CND and the Stop the War Coalition as their own demonstration. After having been promised that there would be only one or two speeches, the Europeans were further distressed to discover that speech after speech after speech was made by an almost exclusively UK set of speakers, focusing mostly just on an anti-war message and not the multitude of issues as represented by the European Social Forum. This is not what the Social Forum is supposed to be about. Indeed, there's been much controversy, and we'll be bringing you more on that later. And one final point before we go to the next track. The next European Social Forum was scheduled to take place in Greece next year, but it's now been delayed until 2006. We're going to play a track now, which is from Moleque de Rua, Street Kids of Brazil, and that was a band that played in a couple of places around the European Social Forum, and on Friday they helped kick off a party at the Indie Media Centre at the Camden Centre near King's Cross, which was a great night. So we'll play one of their tracks now.
Meu bem, eu faço qualquer parada. Se você for embora, vou entrar em parafuso. Sai do rumo, vagabundo para nós. Tem rumo, eu vou caçar você no Paraguai ou na Paraíba. Belém do Pará, Paraná e Curitiba. A puta separa, pega a vida no saco. Agora vem que você para. Seu amor, meu bem, eu topo qualquer parada. Se você for, embora vou entrar em parafuso. Sai do fundo, vagabundo para nós. Eu vou caçar você no Paraguai ou na Paraíba. Belém do Pará, Paraná e Curitiba. Faço você para, sou gavinho do saco. Agora vê se você para. We'll be right back.
venho só com qualquer parada. Se você for embora, vou entrar em para. Sai do jogo, vagabundo para nós do mundo. Eu vou caçar você no Paraguai ou na Paraíba, Belém do Pará, Paraná em Curitiba. Papo me prepara, já me deu um saco, agora me separa.
Next up, we're going to run through a few of the actions and demonstrations which were seen around the European Social Forum throughout Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday.
A pro-capitalist march met up with the ESF march, but police are keeping two marches, or were keeping two marches, separate for a while, imposing a Section 14. The pro-capitalists had banners saying, bring back the slave trade and bombs not bread. They were shouting, get a job, at the ESF marches. The Laboratory of Insurrectionary Imagination, a samba band and clowns, worshipped consumerism outside Selfridges. Ladies and gentlemen were out in London counteracting the vulgarities of everyday life. The backwards intelligence team were out with a comedy critique of the police surveillance forward intelligence team. And for anti-McDonald's Day, activists unfurled McSlurry banners. Starbucks were singled out for special attention, with over 10 actions against them, not least for their court proceedings against Reverend Bill and the Church of Stop Shopping, and their recent attempts to shut down websites critical of the company. A tube party was held on the Circle Line with around 200 people, including Your Mango, people from the Nordic Anti-Capitalist Network and a samba band, and many individuals participating in the merrymaking. However, as with several other events, the police overreacted and the group got caught up at Victoria, where the station was closed and arrests were threatened. There were confirmed two arrests. Both were held for 20 hours, then released without charges, but had DNA and fingerprints taken. Other actions and interventions included a theatrical comedy action against CCTV surveillance cameras subvertising radical urban climbing, highlighting public and private space, and at the Millennium Bridge, tourists were stopped and asked to prove their tourist status. Although the owners of Canary Wharf had an injunction to try and prevent the demonstration for a decent deal for its cleaners, neither the issue nor the protests went away. Canary Wharf is home to some of the most successful and powerful banks in the world, but it is content to let its contract cleaners be paid poverty wages, no sick pay, 15 days holiday and no pension. Amidst a huge police presence, a number of people gathered to and listened to speeches and breached the no protest zone. London Critical Mass and Rising Tide gathered in the streets with the theme of London Underwater, visiting the G8 climate criminals, including ExxonMobil and BP. They were again joined by the Samba Band, who were very busy over the week, and the protests succeeded in moving around the streets of the capital, slowing and stopping traffic. On Thursday, around 200 people participated in an action highlighting the plight of migrants and refugees at Waterloo. At the same time, protests have been simultaneously occurring in Calais and Dover. In London, some 200 to 300 people walked through passport controls at the Eurostar terminal at Waterloo.
And you can read about those actions and interventions and many more on the Indie Media UK website, which has actually been having problems recently since the FBI seized the servers in London. The UK website's been working very slowly, and we understand quite a lot of people had problems uploading their ESF reports to the website. But a lot are up there, so you can read about those actions and more, because, of course, that wasn't all of the actions. But one important thing that happened happened, which was a police action, happened on Friday. Friday morning was the second day of the High Court judicial review hearing appeals over the police decision to abduct three coachloads of people on their way to a US airbase to protest the start of the Iraq invasion last March. Now, London Green MEP Jean Lambert was among those who were there to support the passengers' appeal. She went on to say that the situation should never have happened. It's a waste of everybody's time and money. It's important to be here and defend people's fundamental rights. However, there were disturbing reports of an incident involving police harassment inside and outside of the High Court. When the court adjourned for lunch on Friday, people who were involved in the case were meeting with their legal team in the lobby of the court, but were under close police observation. Now, people asked the policeman who were listening in to leave, as he was interfering with their human rights. He declined to leave and stayed with them, and in fact followed them out of the court, shoving one person and calling for backup, and then chased the people from the court case down the street, later arresting one of them for obstruction of a police officer in the course of his duty. Now, this is quite a shocking case, all in all. The judicial review is a very important stage in a legal process that's been going on for almost a year. Excuse me. And this action by the police is simply not tolerable.
Yeah, I was just going to say, an indie media journalist was actually inside the court. She didn't have a camera, because obviously you can't take your camera into the Royal Courts of Justice. And she was just standing there offering support and observing what was going on. And a police officer inside the court demanded that she show her press card. And she said, but I don't need to show my press card. I'm in a court. This is a public space. How dare you? And she said that she just walked off. So there was a lot of harassment, and the police obviously resented the fact that the appeal was being brought against the actual decision made by the court previously.
Later on in the show, we'll be bringing you some more news and views from some of the interventions that happened during the ESF, and some of which seem to have become quite controversial. But we'll also be bringing you some views about the treatment of people attending the ESF, and more specifically, people who have been attending the autonomous events and the harassment they come under from the police.
Thank you.
the alternative ESF saw the first big indie media centre that Indie Media UK has run. It was very full on throughout the week. There was a cafe, there was speaking events, and of course all the usual facilities offered by an indie media centre. One of the indie media volunteers, Dave, who we have here, went up to Ali Pali. What did you think about up there?
At Ali Pali?
Mm.
Oof, well, I was up there for some reporting and for participation in some of the sessions that were going on up there. It was enormous. I mean, obviously, Alexandra Palace itself is huge. I'm not going to moan too much, but I mean, it kind of reminded me of the worst parts of Glastonbury Festival. It was a marketplace. I mean, it was quite an exciting marketplace. I mean, the Telegraph picks up on this quite nicely, saying they call themselves anti-capitalists and yet they pay £10 for a Che Guevara headscarf or something. It was a very vibrant place. There was some fantastic art up there. There was some great cultural stuff. Obviously, the discussions, there were some absolutely amazing and important discussions going on up there. But the way the venue had been organised, there were nowhere near enough recycling boxes or bins, so consequently the entire venue by the afternoon you were just wading through tidal waves of waste paper on the floor and discarded food wrappers and so on. The food wasn't great either, I have to say. There were a few good caterers there, but on the whole it was kind of your standard like bacon butty.
So is this out of keeping with the usual kind of ESF and World Forum?
Well, last year in Paris there was a very strong focus on the food being organically produced or locally produced, and you know that was one of the key things that they tried to do in Paris, was to ensure that the food provision matched the kind of politics of people inside. I think quite clearly this year it failed. There was also a slight problem with acoustics as well, in that the sessions were all going on right next to each other with just blackout material separating them. Ooh. Which made it very difficult to listen to some of the sessions. But of course people were enthusiastic and got on with it. And there was a tremendous buzz up there, but personally I find it quite horrible. I couldn't stand it for more than a few hours.
Which sessions did you attend that you thought were interesting?
I attended several. I went to several of the media sessions, some on the corporatisation of the media, where Sapinia and Pilger and others were speaking. Pilger fully supported the Indie Media statement of global solidarity with reference to the seizure of the servers, which obviously we've been reporting on for the last couple of weeks. In fact, also the Assembly of the Social Movements, which is, if you like, a separate body to the ESF, but the body that runs in parallel with it, and which makes calls for action. The final declaration that was agreed on Sunday included a statement of support for Indie Media, and fully backed the Indie Media Solidarity Declaration of Support, which demands things like a full investigation into how the servers were seized, but also demands still, because not much is known, but demands to know who was actually involved in authorising the seizure of the servers, you know, who was behind it, the individuals, the organisations, but also the request, you know, the demand, in fact, to know who got access to the data and where the servers went. Because although, as you probably know, the servers were returned last week, Indie Media still doesn't know who returned them and who seized them under what, you know, there's still almost a complete information blackout.
One of the techies during the ESF, and he said at that point they were like taking steps to work out how they could analyse the hard drives just to understand what had been accessed and see if there was any trace of how they'd been opened and copied. Have a statement of, well, a report about some solidarity actions that happened around the world linking to the servers. Indie Media supporters to dump defunct discs on feds. Activists angered by the multilateral seizure of Indie Media hard drives last October the 7th will be turning over piles of old drives to intelligence agencies across the world this week in symbolic protests against what many are denouncing as a serious violation of communication information rights. The global action is called Operation Hard Drive-By. The first wave of solidarity actions took place last week in the Netherlands, where activists delivered symbolic old hardware to the Italian consulate in Amsterdam. The next day, activists in San Francisco, USA, handed over hardware to the FBI. Here you go, here's our junk. In Houston, members of the IMC delivered a letter to the Swiss consulate. For more information on that story, you should go to the global website in the central column there. That's indymedia.org.
One thing I should say, actually, about some of the technical infrastructure, it was quite interesting being up at Alexandra Palace where the main ESF was going on, because there weren't any public internet access computers for people to use. So you had, you know, tens of thousands of people up at Alexandra Palace and no way of actually contacting the outside world. It was shameful, really. There's also a van that was parked outside for radio broadcasters to use, but incredibly the ESF up at Alexandra Palace didn't sort out getting them connection to the internet, and they couldn't actually run a power line to them either. So the people who
were mast on top of Ali Pali, you'd think that it would be the place for communication.
You would think that, but of course that wasn't the case. These poor people who were working out of the van were told they had to bring along a diesel generator if they wanted power. They couldn't even get a power line run from Alexandra Palace. I went to the media centre, the official ESF media centre. They had about 25 computers in there, but that was about it. At the Indie Media Centre in Camden Centre, there were around, 10, 20, 30, there were around 40 machines running for people to use the internet with. And then I think it probably peaked at around something like 30 to 40 laptops in operation as well. So I think at the peak there were about 80 computers running there. And the centre facilitated a whole range of different people working on various media projects, from French audio production, people doing radio, through to people updating websites in Iraq.
We managed to stream as well. I think we managed to stream the meetings there.
There were several of the meetings streamed directly from the Camden Centre, including the human rights discussion on Friday morning from Genoa to Guantanamo. There was an awful lot of content and discussion around communication rights, a fabulous opportunity for networking people together. There was a great party on Friday night.
Did they stream at Ali Pali, out of interest? Did they share the meetings? Or
no, none of the...
So nothing got shared?
Nothing came out of Ali Pali in that respect.
So the whole idea of sharing and grassroots and bottom-up just didn't really materialise?
Certainly not in any relation to the media, no. Certainly there was very little community media coming out of Alexandra Palace. But, I mean, this has been one of the big debates throughout the days of the ESF, both inside and outside of the ESF. People were discussing ways to make the social forum better, to make it closer to the ideals it claims to represent, and also to work more closely on archiving the ESF to share with people who can't attend.
What stopped them really opening up the process? What do you think was the reason behind this not sharing of media?
Well, that's quite a loaded question, really. I mean, obviously there were media activists who were participating in the process of the European Social Forum for the last year, and tried repeatedly to lobby for many projects and for many standards around media, but it just wasn't something that was taken seriously. Certainly the audio archiving of the ESF was deemed to be not a priority by the GLA, not a core priority.
So, overall, who would you say were the groups that actually decided the priorities?
It was the coordinating committees, theoretically, which involved people from many different organisations. But personally, I think, and many other people think, that the Socialist Workers' Party and a group called Socialist Action tightly controlled a lot of these processes, or certainly discouraged a lot of participation. But ultimately, the GLA, who were one of the main funders, to the tune of something like 480k, they had a lot of power in making decisions over how the money was spent, which obviously affected the event.
So, let me get this straight. It's a grassroots event funded by the GLA, which is essentially funded by government, funded by our taxes, but there was no facilities there for people to just go and join in. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, obviously there were facilities for people to go and join in, but I was talking specifically about the media facilities.
That's
there.
That's what I mean, there was
no internet access or public access computers for the punters. Obviously there was this 25 PC press area which people could access, but nothing for the normal people.
Okay, thanks very much.
Quando a noite vem, o som do moleque também chega na favela.
Here with us today, Aresh from the More Gardens campaign. Aresh has been on the show before, and I think we've explained before that More Gardens is about saving community gardens that have been around New York that are trying to be bulldozed in favour of gentrification. So what's been going on lately in More Gardens?
Well, over in New York City, we have very similar issues and to what's happening here. I mean, to us, the vision of community gardens is one step in the larger process of having New York City a sustainable city. I mean, a lot of energy, resources, and minerals goes into the cities, destruction of forests, flying in kiwis from New Zealand, Australia, to kill the people with the need for gas and petrol and all that stuff. So to us, it's like we need to have our food in our cities, grow it, and sustain the people as much as possible, and then to have perimeter farms that would then also bring in the food into the big cities. So that's the vision that we have, and community gardens are where people have done this without the support of the government. And actually, it was at the time when this happened, similar to Argentina and other places. So we are back into making sure that these hundreds of gardens that have been worked at over so many years become permanent, and to also then become more.
And what has been that process of making them permanent?
The process has been very interesting. They during Giuliani's, the last mayor's time, he went and tried to bulldoze every single community garden, about 650, 700 of them. And so what the people did, and Moore Gardens in particular, was very good at direct action. So we built giant frogs that people lived inside and locked into. We went out there in the streets and locked into the City Hall Park steps in the trees around it, and said, we're coming out and showing that you guys have your own parks, but the people have not, and we need to balance that in a good way. Most of these community gardens are in places where people are of lower income, working class people, as well as people of color, Puerto Rican and African American.
How did your mulching day go? I got an email from you inviting people to mulch. How many people turned up to mulch?
Well, this is during the Republican National Convention, and many demonstrators, people came there. We had a green block, which is groups from San Francisco all the way to Connecticut and Maine, who came down and said, all right, we're not just here to fuck shit up, but we're here to fix shit up.
No swearing on the radio. We're getting into trouble.
Beep, beep, beep. So one of the things that did happen was that folks all came and started fixing up the community gardens, cleaning up the neighborhoods, and one of the mulching was that you put cardboard on the earth where it's full of weeds, and then on top of that you put wood chips, and again the wood chips are from trees that have been cut down and being thrown out, and the cardboard is also recycling stuff. And so then what you do is you create a new earth, and you get rid of the weeds all at the same time.
Did you have any bother from security agencies whilst people were mulching?
Well, this is interesting, because in the areas where we were working, we didn't put as much media as everybody else would have liked, partly because this gardens are in negotiations directly with city agencies. And so what we asked was that we need to just do the right thing and the process to be that way, and not to put the word out that, you know, anti such and such are out there. We said this is pro, this is just everybody, Republicans, Mr. Bush is welcome to come, everyone's welcome here to fix what's needed to be done. But to us, I mean, Moore Gardens has been very, very focused on saying that, you know, protesting and voting is all good, but the bigger process that happens once every 4 years, but the main thing is to do what's right in our everyday lives, in our everyday actions, and from a personal point of view itself. So you go out there, you plant the seed, you make the right things, and you buy the right stuff, and you don't buy plastic if you can. Try that for a week.
And finally, did any Republicans come and help?
I believe there were one or two people who had more right-wing ideas, but they were all just digging and planting and growing. And right now in the South Bronx, we have over 20, maybe 50 more gardens that are in danger of being bulldozed. So if anybody is interested in coming to New York City and working with us on legal, direct action, planting, growing, we have greenhouses, please come and check www.moregardens, and we'll host you and set you up. It'd be lovely to have people from the city.
You said www.moregardens, moregardens.org.
.org.
So www.moregardens.org.
So that was Rincon Criollo, one of the community gardens in the South Bronx, and they too are sending all their love to all the community gardens here in London.
And back to the European Social Forum, one of the most controversial things that has happened, which seems to be exploding into some kind of argument and discussion, certainly being mentioned in the letters pages in The Guardian, was an intervention that happened on Saturday evening, where around 200 people gained free entry into the European Social Forum. Tickets were £20 or £30 to make an intervention against Ken Livingstone, the Mayor of London, who was due to speak at a plenary which was about uniting anti-racist and anti-fascist campaigns around Europe. Around 200 people gained entry to the seminar where he was due to speak and occupied the stage for around half an hour, making a set of interventions. There were a whole series of speakers who addressed the platform, and including a statement was read out by Babel's coordinators, who Babel's are the network of volunteer interpreters and translators who effectively enable the large meetings at the Social Forum to take place. Excuse me, they read, or somebody read their statement, which was incredibly critical of the European Social Forum in London. I'll just read an extract of that. It says, "Many opportunities of experimentation and innovation have been missed during the organisation of this forum, resulting in the exclusion of many people, organisations, networks, groups, and even countries. This is in total contradiction to the Porto Alegre Charter." That's the charter of the World Social Forum. They went on to say, "Instead, classical neoliberal practices of organisation, management and service delivery have been employed, with the result that the forum has been entirely dependent on the state." They went on to say that the forum has been a distressing experience of demobilisation, not only in terms of the number of delegates, given that it was half the size of previous years, but also in the chronic shortage of volunteers. They also complained about the racist immigration and asylum policies of the British Labour government, which prevented many of their interpreters coming from Turkey, Russia, Romania, and countries such as Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco. There were many other interventions made on the microphone condemning the involvement of the Socialist Worker Party and Socialist Action, or rather their control of the process, and the exclusion of many people from the forum. Now, when those people left after around half an hour, the event, the plenary on racism and fighting fascism, went ahead, but of course without Ken Livingstone. When the people who'd been protesting left and started to march away from Alexandra Palace, there was a scuffle with police who seemed to completely overreact, according to eyewitnesses, and made several arrests. And this seemed to be a pattern that was repeated throughout the social forum, that the police were overreacting and also harassing activists. Now, following this intervention, a letter appeared in the Guardian letters pages, which came from Lee Jasper, who's Ken Livingstone's senior advisor on race and policing. Now, he condemned the action against Ken Livingstone, but actually said the intervention had nothing to do with Ken Livingstone or the organisation of the ESF, but actually said the action had everything to do with white anarchists attacking black people and trying to prevent them from speaking about racism. Now, obviously, this has caused quite an uproar, and today in The Guardian there is a letter signed by several people, including the Secretary of the Newham Monitoring Project and the Chair of the National Civil Rights Movement, which essentially accuses Lee Jasper, Ken Livingstone's advisor, of obscuring, trying to cover up the reasons for the intervention, and accuses him of playing the race card. They say that they witnessed the protest, and while they say there's never excuse for any sort of scuffles, there certainly were scuffles when people took to the microphone, and this was one of the issues that the black chair seems to have been hit during the scuffle. The people signing the letter today say the protest was supported by a large section of the audience, and that banners clearly made out that the protest was highlighting the Labour Party's policies on racism and war, and calling for the mayor not to be allowed to speak. So there's an incredible argument now developing, where it seems that Ken Livingstone's paid advisor is trying to accuse people who are protesting against Ken Livingstone and against the organising process of the ESF of being racists. Quite simply incredible. There've also been another incident that seems in some way related to this, which was the following morning, when people were on their way to the main ESF demonstration. It seems a trainload of activists were harassed by the police, who were following them and taking pictures of them. Now, we don't know exactly what happened, but it seems that as the activists tried to get off a train, the police tried to prevent them getting off the train, and the developed some pushing and shoving. The activists finally managed to get to a tube station. Arriving at King's Cross later, however, they were corralled by the police, who had something like 10 riot vans parked up outside King's Cross station, and they surrounded this group of around 30 activists and detained them for well over an hour and made several arrests. The activists who were corralled claimed this was complete intimidation and a complete overreaction. Indeed, many of the people who were arrested have been released without charge. And again, it raised the questions of overreaction of the police. And certainly, given that people were on their way to a demonstration, it also raised questions about the right to assemble and the right to protest and the right to freedom of movement.
And later on at Trafalgar Square, there was some arrests made of an indie media volunteer and somebody else relating to people trying to get a platform to speak about the police overreaction. Two people were arrested in a quite outrageous way. What happened?
Well, it's kind of unclear exactly what happened. Certainly when people were being detained at King's Cross, obviously the news spread quite quickly that this was occurring, and people at the front of the demonstration wanted an announcement made so that other people would know that demonstrators on their way to the protest were being detained by police. Well, no announcement was made there. Later in the afternoon, people were requesting to make an announcement from the stage in Trafalgar Square, and others were more vocally shouting for an intervention to be made to report what was going on. And it seems a scuffle broke out with the Stop the War Coalition stewards and some of the people who were asking for an intervention on the microphone. What certainly seems to have happened is that the stewards and the private security called in the police to arrest people who were backstage.
They were actually working.
Well, people who were backstage and wanting to make an intervention on the microphone. I mean, we're almost out of time on the show because we've got an outro piece to play. But you can read all about this and the ensuing discussion on Indie Media, indiemedia.org.uk. And obviously, there'll be more news on this next week.
And another story that we didn't get time for today, which I think is very important to check out, is the recent incursion into Palestine. It's got quite good coverage on the World Indie Media site and global at indiemedia.org. There's a very good Palestine report and a report by Mohammed Amer about the situation currently in Gaza. It's quite a good piece of writing. So that's about it from us. So
remember, you can check out lots of coverage from the European Social Forum. It wasn't all argument and doom and gloom. There were some amazing discussions, and over the next weeks, people will be writing those up and posting them on Indie Media and other sites. We suggest you check them out. And now we go to an outro, which is audio from one of the sessions at the Indie Media Camden Centre.
The autonomous spaces were wicked.
So Tariq Gargul, like I said, he is one of the five who was released from Guantanamo earlier this year. Yeah, that's fine. So Tariq, assalamu alaikum. The first question I'd really like to ask you, because we saw these images, we saw the images of people in orange with, you know, ear sounders, with goggles, with gloves. What happened when you were put in that position? What was going on in your mind? What did you think was going? Where were you going to? What had the Americans told you at that point when you were in Afghanistan?
We had the idea that it's possible that we'd be sent to. We were told that anyone who would be wearing orange would be sent to Cuba. And we had seen from Kandahar, we had seen people being sent. But personally, I thought I was going to be brought back home. I couldn't see why I would be sent to Cuba. And I suffered 3 months in Kandahar, and then the day came. Then the day came when they dressed me up in orange, and basically. Put a mask on me and over my eyes, and I was shackled in chains and injected with I don't know what. Then I was put on a flight, an aeroplane, for 12 to 13 hours. I'm cold air blowing out of my head. Which caused me pain, and basically not allowed to use a toilet. All my food was given. For 12 hours on one flight, then we changed the plane landing. Then I was put on another flight for maybe 7-8 hours. And suffering the whole way, not using the toilet, urinating in my trousers. And then we reached, that was it, then we reached Cuba. And that's it.
Okay. When you reached Cuba, did you know where you were?
I had an idea, but I wasn't sure. No.
After that, what actually happened when they took you off the flight? What was the process?
Well, they took me into a room and was stripped naked, full cavity surgery was done, pictures were taken. I was taken to another room, into a clinic. I was placed on a bed and given 2 injections. And then basically that was then afterwards taken.
Did you know what the injections were that you were given?
No.
And you weren't asked that whether you wanted the injections?
No, I was basically, I couldn't refuse them. I mean, I asked what they was and they were just there, we're here to help you and whatever, and that's it. They didn't say what it was.
Okay. After this, where were you led to? I mean, were you put into the cages then straight away, or what was the situation?
Well, at this point, they didn't know what nationality I was. So, and I was suffering from frostbite. I was in severe pain in my feet and my joints. So, I explained to them, I told them that I was a British citizen, and basically that, I think maybe when they took me serious and they put me in a hospital for a week, and then after a week of basically cleaned up my wounds, and then they put me in a cage with the rest of the prisoners.
The master sergeant on that film said that there's no torture and abuse in Guantanamo Bay. Would you agree with that?
Not at all. It was all torture and humiliation. Every day was, torture. And they wouldn't let us, they wouldn't let us pray in peace. They would blaspheme constantly. They would grab out the Holy Quran and step on it. They would write swear words inside it. They would shave our beards. They would molest us. They would pretend to search us and touch our private parts. And the list goes on and on.
Were they interrogating you as well?
I wouldn't call it interrogation, but they took us so-called interrogation, which basically they wasn't asking interrogating questions. They would, they would just make a blaspheme, basically. That's what it would be. And they would say, where's your, just like what happened recently here, they would ask, they say, where's your God? They would open the door and say, there's no one here to help you, you're not going home. You'll be here for the rest of your life. They used to work at the air conditioning and leave you sitting there for 8 to 10 hours, chained up to the floor with no... I'm not using a toilet or anything.
Did the British government help you in any way when they came to visit? Did they take on board your concerns?
Not at all, no. They just came, asked their questions and then went. Even in Kandahar before I was sent to Cuba, they said that we're bringing you back home. So, I told them everything. I didn't leave nothing out and nothing. And so...
Now that you are back, do you feel happy to be back with your family? Do you feel anger towards those people you feel might have let you down?
Yeah, I feel oppressed. I'm back, and it's like I was in, I was away for like 2.5 years, and I suffered for 2.5 years, and I've come back, and I've got no hope whatsoever. I'm just confused. I don't know. I can't work, and no one's helping me. I'm treated like I'm worse than anyone in this country would be treated, and we're not acknowledging that the suffering that went through.
Okay. Is there a message that you think that yourself and those who are left behind there that needs to be said to people here and to the wider world? What should we be doing?
basically speaking out, standing up for your rights, and exposing the corrupted people, and helping in every way you can.
Okay. Jazakallah khair. Assalamu alaikum.